The Daphimerian Zabrak sat cross-legged on the Duracrete floor, recounting Fastidius the surveillance mission he had completed at the Jedi Temple weeks earlier, at the height of the Yanchori crisis.
It sickened me to see how easily the reptilian infiltrators were deceived, Master. Even by the fair-haired human female sentry they thought they had taken by surprise outside the temple. From where I watched, I knew that she had feigned surprise when her lightsaber failed to penetrate her assailant's Cortosa's shield, and that she had merely been faking unconsciousness when the Yanchori had yanked her to her feet and she impaled him on her activated blade.
Maul snarled, revealing sharply filed teeth.
Their stupidity allowed me to revel in the fact that their mission had been compromised, that the Jedi were simply luring them into a trap.
The abandoned Limerge building had become the Assassin's home and training center, the works and the fringes of the nearby Phobosi district, his nocturnal haunts. Circling him with the cowl of his robe raised over his head, Sidious asked,
"The Jedi gained your respect?"
"They might have, had the infiltrators showed any skill. Had I been leading them."
Sidious stopped.
"The mission would have been successful? Jedi knights and padawans killed, younglings slaughtered?"
"I'm certain of it, Master."
"Just you, against the masters who make up the High Council?"
"By hiding and striking, I could have killed many."
Plagueis was right, Sidious thought. "I have made him prideful." The Yanchori stratagem had failed in any case. Additional Jedi had died, but Jedi deaths had never been the primary reason for instigating the crisis. What mattered was that Valorum had triumphed, with some help from Palpatine, it was true, but mostly on his own, by managing to bring Senators Yarua, Tychus, Farr, and others over to his side and establishing an embargo. But with his political currency spent, Valorum's position was more tenuous than ever. Even a hint of scandal, and the Senate would lose what little confidence they had in him.
"You are formidable," Sidious said at last. "But you are not a one-being army. And I've not spent years training you only to have you sacrifice yourself. When I bestowed upon you the title of Darth, it was not in reward for your having survived dangerous missions, starvation, and assassin droids, but for your obedience and loyalty. No doubt you will have ample opportunities to demonstrate your superior skill to the Jedi, but bringing down the Order is not your mandate, your hatred of them notwithstanding."
Maul lowered his head, displaying his crown of sharp-tipped horns in their red and black field.
"Master, as long as those who do derive the joy and satisfaction, I would."
"We shall see, my apprentice, but until then, there are matters we need to attend to."
He motioned for Maul to stand and follow him to the holoprojector table and transmission grid, the same ones the Grand had left behind decades before, but fully modernized and enhanced.
"Stand out of view of the cams," Sidious said, indicating a place. "For now, we want to keep you in reserve."
"But..."
"Be patient. You will have a part to play in this."
Sidious settled into a high-backed chair that wrapped around him like a throne and had a remote control built into one of the arms, his thoughts set aswirl by what he was about to do. Had Plagueis felt the enormity of the moment on Naboo all those years before, when he had revealed his true self? Removed, for the first time, the mask he wore in public? As empowering as it might have been, had the moment also been tainted by a kind of nostalgia, the loss of something so personal, so defining? What had been secret would never be secret again. The calm caught Viceroy Newt Gunray in the midst of eating, and without the ear-flapped tiara and ornate azure stone collar that made him look like a gesture.
"Greetings, Viceroy," Sidious said.
The nictitating membranes of the Nymordian's crimson eyes went into spasm, and his mottled muzzle twitched.
What? This is a security's. How did you...
Don't bother attempting to trace the origin of this communication, Sidious said, while Gunray's tapered gray fingers flew across the keypad of his holotable. A trace will only lead you in circles and waste what limited time we have.
How dare you intrude?
Recently I sent you a gift, a red-spotted pylite. Gunray stared.
You? You sent it?
I trust you had sense enough to have it scanned for monitoring devices. Gunray whirled to look at something off-cam, probably the crested bird itself.
Of course I did. What was your purpose in sending it?
His accent elongated the words and softened the T sounds. Consider it a token of my appreciation for the unrewarded work you have done for the Trade Federation. The Directorate fails to recognize your contributions.
Why are you hiding inside the cowl of your cloak?
It is the clothing of my order, Viceroy.
You are a cleric?
Do I seem a holy man to you? Gunray's expression soured.
I demand to see your face.
You have yet to earn the privilege of seeing me.
Privilege? Who do you think you are?
Are you certain you want to know?
I demand to know.
Sidious's smile barely escaped the cowl. Even better then. I am a Sith Lord. There. I said it. I said it.
Sith Lord?
Gunray repeated. The response came from deep inside him, from the center of his true being. You have permission to refer to me as Darth Sidious.
I've not heard of Darth Sidious.
Ah, but now you have. Our partnership is forged. Gunray shook his head.
I am not looking for a partner.
Sidious showed some of his face. Don't pretend to be content with your position in the Trade Federation, or that you are without aspirations. We are now partners in the future. Gunray made a hissing sound.
This is a joke. The Sith have been extinct for 1,000 years.
That's precisely what the Republic and the Jedi Order would like you to believe. But we never disappeared. Through the centuries, we have taken up just causes and revealed ourselves to select beings like yourself. Gunray sat back in his chair.
I don't understand. Why me?
You and I share an avid interest in where the Republic is headed, and I have deemed it time that we begin to work in concert.
I won't be part of any covert schemes.
Truly? Sidious said. Do you think that out of millions of influential beings, I would choose you without knowing you inside and out? I realize that your voracious desires stem from the cruel conditions of your upbringing. You and your fellow grubs in ruthless competition for limited supplies of fungus. But I understand. We are all shaped by our infantile desires, our longing for affection and attention, our fears of death. And judging by how far you have come, it's clear that you were unrivaled and continue to be. Your years in the Senate, for example, the clandestine meetings in the Klaus building, the fallen restaurant in the Crimson Corridor, the funds you diverted to Pax Team and Oxmo, the secret dealings with Damask Holdings, the assassination of Vidar Kim.
Enough! Enough! Do you mean to blackmail me?
Sidious delayed his reply. Perhaps you didn't hear me when I spoke of a partnership.
I heard you. Now tell me what you want of me.
Nothing more than your cooperation. I will bring about great changes for you, and in exchange, you will do the same for me. Gunray looked worried.
You claim to be a Dark Lord, but how do I know that you are? How do I know you have any ability to help me?
I found you a rare bird.
That hardly validates your claim.
Sidious nodded. I understand your skepticism. I could, of course, demonstrate my powers, but I'm reluctant to convince you in that way. Gunray sniffed.
I haven't time for this.
Is the pilot nearby?
Just behind me,
Gunray allowed. Show me.
Gunray widened the scope of the holotable's cams to include the bird, perched in a cage that was little more than a circle of precious metal, crowned with a stasis field generator. I was concerned when I extracted him from the jungle habitat that he would die, Sidious said. And yet he appears to be at home in his new environment.
His song suggests as much.
What if I told you that I could reach across space and time and strangle him where he perches? Gunray was aghast.
You couldn't. I doubt that even a Jedi...
Are you challenging me, Viceroy?
Yes,
he said abruptly. Then just as quickly...
No, wait.
Sidious shifted in the chair. You value the bird, this symbol of wealth.
I am the envy of my peers for possessing it.
Would not actual wealth generate even greater envy? Gunray grew flustered.
How can I answer when I know that you might strangle me should I refuse you?
Sidious loosed an elaborate sigh. Partners don't strangle each other, Viceroy. I would prefer to earn your trust. Are you agreeable to that?
I might be.
Then here is my first gift to you. The Trade Federation is going to be betrayed. By Naboo, by the Republic, by the members of the Directorate. Only you can provide the leadership that will be needed to keep the Federation from splintering. But first, we must see to it that you are promoted to the Directorate.
The current director would never welcome a Nymoidian.
Tell me what it would take, Sidious started, then cut himself off. No, never mind. Let me surprise you by arranging a promotion.
You would do that and ask nothing in return?
For the time being. If and when I've earned your full trust, I will expect you to take my suggestions to heart.
I will, Darth Sidious.
Then we will speak again soon. Sidious deactivated the holoprojector and sat in silence. There is a world in the Videnda sector called Dovala, he said to Maul a long moment later. You will not have heard of it, but it is a source of lomite ore, which is essential to the production of transferrasteel. Two companies, Lomite Limited and Intergalactic Ore, currently control the mining and shipping operations. But for some time, the Trade Federation has had its sights on overseeing Dorvala.
What is that meaning, Master?
Maul asked. For now, only that you acquaint yourself with Dorvala, for it may prove the key to ensnaring Gunray in our grasp.
Chapter 25, The Discreet Charm of the Meritocracy. A more outlandish quartet hadn't set foot, belly, claw, and jaw on Sojourn in 20 years. A half-breed Thelan female, her hut master, his Twi'lek majordomo, and his Chevin chief of security crossed the fort's leaf-littered courtyard and entered Plagueis's reception room. With the exception of the Thelan, they looked as if they might have wandered in from the Greel forests to consort with the creatures that had constructed nests and burrows in the fort's dank corridors and lofty turrets. Plagueis and 114D were waiting just inside the gaping entrance.
Welcome, Jabba the Silagic Tayor,
Plagueis said through his transpirator mask. Droids had restored some semblance of order to the room and installed tables and chairs. Morning light streamed through square openings high in the wall, and a fire crackled in the stone hearth.
A pleasure to see you again after so many years, Magister Damask,
Jabba said in coarse basic. The ageless criminal lolled his huge tongue and maneuvered his great slug body onto a low platform the droids had erected. Gazing around, he added,
You and your droid must visit my little place on Tatooine in the western Dune Sea.
Someday soon,
Plagueis said, as he lowered himself into an armchair across from the platform. Like Toydarians and Yenchori, huts were immune to force suggestions. Had Jabba known how many of his species Plagueis had experimented on over the decades, he might not have been as sociable. But then the Hutt's own penchant for ruthlessness and torture were legendary. As a tattoo on his arm attested, he cared only for members of his clan. He didn't bother to introduce his subordinates by name, but as was often the case with many of the thugs and ne'er-do-wells with whom he surrounded himself, two of them had reputations that preceded them. The pink-complexioned Twi'lek was Bib Fortuna, a former spice smuggler whose own species had turned its back on him. Tall and red-eyed, he had sharp little teeth and thick, shiny leku growing from a hairless cranium that looked as if it had been inexpertly stuffed with rocks. The Cheven, a 2-meter-high snout that had sprouted arms, legs, and tail, was Ifant Mon, celebrated as a warrior among his own kind and mildly force-sensitive. He wore a blanket someone might have thrown over him to hide his ugliness. Plagueis knew from contacts in the Trade Federation that Mon was involved in a smuggling operation on technophobic Syria, supplying swoops to a gang of young upstarts. The Thelan was unknown to Plagueis. Pale and shapely, she had lustrous orange hair and purple beauty marks that ran down her face and neck to disappear beneath a revealing costume.
Diva Shaliqua,
Jabba said, when he realized that Plagueis was studying her.
A singer in the band.
As her name suggests.
A gift from Ingoda, in place of credits owed to me.
Jabba's big eyes settled on the Thelan.
She and Diva Funquita came as a pair, but I made Funquita a present to Gardula in the hope of smoothing over our lingering rivalry. My first mistake. The second, introducing Shaliqua to Romeo Treblanc, who would move worlds to possess her.
Notorious for his gambling, Treblanc owned the galaxy's opera house on Coruscant. Why Jabba chose to associate with gamblers and other lowlifes was a mystery to Plagueis. In some ways, the Hutt's illicit empire was the inverse of Higo Damask's, where, if nothing else, the criminals were at least politicians, corporate honchos, and financiers. His coming to sojourn was both uncharacteristic and unexpected.
Are you here to talk about Treblanc or Gardula?
Plagueis asked. Jabba reacted in annoyance.
As always, straight to the heart of the matter. But I can appreciate the fact that you're a busy mune.
He wriggled to adjust his position on the platform.
I know you were instrumental 30 years ago in giving Gardula the run of Tatooine as a base for her slavery operations and pod racing events. I've come this far to inform you that Tatooine will soon have a new overseer.
He gestured to himself.
Me.
Plagueis said nothing for a long moment.
I was under the impression that Tatooine was already as much yours as Gardula's.
Appearances can be deceiving. I've tried to undermine her influence by fomenting distrust among the so-called Sand People, the Tusken Raiders. But success at chasing her off-world continues to elude me.
Plagueis made an adjustment to the breath mask.
How can I help?
Jabba appraised him.
I happen to know that Ardula hasn't been able to make good on the loans you extended. What she earns from events like the Boonta Eve Classic, she loses to gamblers.
Not much is true, but what of it?
I want you to stop funding her, so I can starve her out. Ooh.
Plagueis shrugged.
Your information is incomplete, Jabba. I haven't funded her enterprises in a decade.
Jabba balled his hands in anger.
You have influence over members of the banking clan and the Trade Federation who are funding her.
Plagueis lifted his head, as if in revelation.
I see. And what can I expect in exchange?
To start with, a better percentage of the profits from the races and other enterprises.
Plagueis frowned in disappointment.
You must know that I've no need of credits, Jabba. And you wouldn't have come this far, as you say, unless you had learned a few things that might sway me over to your side.
Jabba wriggled, restraining his anger.
In return for your help, I will weaken Black Sun's influence with the Trade Federation Directorate.
I need no assistance.
Plagueis leaned forward in the armchair.
What do you know that I may not know?
Jabba inflated his body, then allowed the air to escape him in a protracted, mirthless laugh.
I know something you may not yet know about the Bandogora.
Plagueis raised himself somewhat in the chair. Hideously masked Bandogora assassins had become a growing concern in the Outer Rim, posing a problem to the leadership of some of the cartels Plagueis backed.
Now you have my interest, Jabba.
The cult has a new leader.
Jabba went on, happy to have the high ground.
A human female. She has entered into a plan with Gardula. A Malastare dub named Sibolto. And a Republic senator to distribute contaminated death sticks as a means of supplying the Bandogora with brain-dead recruits.
Plagueis stretched out with the Force to peer into the hut. Jabba wasn't lying.
This human female...
I've heard rumors.
Again, Jabba was telling the truth.
Rumors will suffice for now.
The hut rubbed his meaty hands together.
Her name is Komare Voza, and word has it that she is a former Jedi.
Plagueis knew the name only too well. Some 10 years earlier, Komare Voza had been a Padawan of Master Dooku. Behind each of the Rotunda's hover platform docking stations extended wedge-shaped office complexes more than half a kilometer in length, where senators met with one another, entertained guests, and on rare occasions carried out the work they had been elected or appointed to perform. Some of the offices were sealed environments in which the atmospheres of member worlds were replicated. Others, especially those belonging to hive species, were staffed by hundreds of beings who performed their duties in cubicles that resembled nectocomb cells. By comparison, Naboo's was rather prosaic in design and adornment, and yet unrivaled in terms of the number of high-profile visitors it received.
I'm giving thought to leaving the Order,
Master Dooku told Palpatine in the windowless room that was the Senator's private study.
I can no longer abide the decisions of the Council, and I have to be free to speak my mind about the wretched state of the Republic.
Palpatine didn't reply, but thought.
Finally.
With Darth Maul traveling to Dorvala on his first mission, Palpatine had been preoccupied all afternoon, and now Dooku's disclosure, long anticipated, and yet still something of a surprise.
This isn't the first time you've been exasperated with the Council, he said carefully. And it probably won't be the last.
Dooku shook his head firmly.
Never more than this. Even after Galadron, I've no recourse.
Frigid Galadron was years behind him, but for Dooku the incident remained an open wound. A local governor had succeeded in luring the Jedi into a conflict with Mandalorian mercenaries that had left 11 Jedi dead, and the true Mandalorians, largely innocent of the charges that had been leveled against them, wiped out, save for one. Since then, and on each occasion he and Palpatine had met, Dooku had begun to look less and less like a Jedi master, and more like the noble he would have been on his native Serenno. Meticulously groomed, he carried himself like an aristocrat, affecting tailored tunics and trousers, and a velvety black cloak that gave him a dashing theatrical look. His slightly curved lightsaber hilt, too, might have been a prop, though he was known to be one of the Order's most skilled duelists. And behind a mask of arrogant civility, Palpatine knew him to be capable of great cruelty.
By request from the Senate, Dooku went on, the Council dispatched several Jedi to Baltizar, and my former Padawan somehow succeeded in accompanying them.
Palpatine nodded soberly.
I know something of that. Baltazar's senator petitioned for help in fending off attacks by the Bando Gora.
Sadistic abductors and assassins, Dooku said in anger. Military action was called for, not Jedi intercession. But no matter. The Council complied with the request. And now, Kumare Voza and the others are believed to be dead.
Palpatine raised an eyebrow.
The young woman who became infatuated with you?
The same, Dooku said quietly. At Galadran, she fought brutally against the Mandalorians. Almost as if in an attempt to impress me. As a result, I told the Council that she wasn't ready for the trials and Jedi knighthood. Compounding their initial error in dispatching Jedi, Master Yoda and the rest have refused to send reinforcements to search for survivors.
Palpatine considered it.
If Baltazar was meant to be another attempt to impress you, all Kumare Voza did was prove that you were right about her all along.
Dooku regarded him.
Perhaps, but the failure is mine.
He ran a hand over his short beard.
As skilled as I am with a lightsaber, I've turned out to be an ineffectual teacher. Master Qui-Gon Jinn has become a solitary and secretive rogue. And now Voza... He snorted. I declined to be a member of the Council in order to devote myself to diplomacy, and look how that has turned out. The Republic is sliding deeper into chaos.
You're one man against a galaxy full of scoundrels, Palpatine said.
Dooku's eyes flashed.
One man should be able to make a difference if he is powerful enough.
Palpatine let the silence linger.
You would claim the title of Count of Serenno?
By right of birth. My family is agreeable. Now it's simply a matter of informing the High Council.
Has anyone ever left the Order?
19 before me.
Have you shared your discontent with any of them?
Only Master Sifo Dyas.
Of course.
Dooku looked up.
He worries that I'm going to do something rash.
Leaving the Order isn't rash enough.
He fears that I will denounce the Council openly and reveal how divided its members are about answering to the Senate.
He looked Palpatine in the eye.
I've half a mind to join your cause.
Palpatine touched his chest.
My cause?
Dooku adopted a sly smile.
I understand politics, my friend. I know that you have to be circumspect about what you say and to whom.
But that the disenfranchised worlds of the Outer Rim enjoy any support at all is largely due to you.
You speak honestly, and you champion the underprivileged. And you may be the only one capable of bringing the Republic back from the brink. Unless, of course, you have been lying to me all these years.
Palpatine made light of the remark. Perhaps a few lies of omission.
Those I am willing to forgive, Dooku said. Whether or not we become partners in addition to being allies.
Palpatine interlocked his hands. It is an interesting notion. We would have to deepen our conversations, become completely honest with each other, bare our innermost thoughts and feelings to determine whether we truly share the same goals.
I'm being honest when I tell you that the Republic needs to be torn down and built up again from the ground up.
That is a tall order.
Tall, indeed.
It might require a civil war.
And how far from that are we now?
Dooku fell silent for a moment, then said,
The Senate grapples with trying to solve disputes the Jedi often see firsthand. What laws are enacted only follow from our having brought our lightsabers to bear.
It was the Jedi who pledged to support the Republic.
The Order's place in this is a matter Sifo Dyas and I have discussed endlessly, Dooku snapped. But the members of the Council are not similarly inclined. They are entrenched in archaic thinking and slow to embrace change.
He paused and adopted a sinister look.
Don't let yourself be fooled, Palpatine. They see dark times ahead. In fact, they think of little else. That's why they have allowed the Jedi to become involved in parochial conflicts like those at Galadron, Yenchor, and Balthazar, which are like brush fires born of wind-blown embers from a massive blaze just beyond the horizon. But instead of actually rising up against the corruption in the Republic, perhaps disbanding the Senate entirely for a period of time, they have become fixated on prophecy. They await the coming of a prophesized Redeemer, who will bring balance to the Force and restore order.
A Redeemer? Palpatine stared at him in authentic surprise. You've never alluded to this prophecy.
Nor would I now, if I still thought of myself as loyal to the Order.
I never considered that the Force needed to be balanced.
Dooku's lip curled. The Order interprets the prophecy to mean that the dark tide needs to be stemmed.
You don't accept it?
Dooku had an answer ready. Here is the truth of it. The Jedi could fulfill the prophecy on their own, if they were willing to unleash the full powers of the Force.
The full powers of the Force, Palpatine said. I'm afraid you've lost me. Dooku blew out his breath.
Perhaps it's something we can discuss in the future.
You've made your decision, then? Dooku nodded.
If one more Jedi dies because of indolence on the part of the Republic and moral equivocation on the part of the Council, I will leave the Temple and refuse to look back.
No sooner had Dooku left the office than Sidious was donning his cloak and hurrying off to his next appointment. Hailing a skycab in Senate Plaza, he instructed the grand driver to deliver him to Tanic Spaceport. Relaxing back into the padded seat, he exhaled for what felt like the first time all day. In the space of a standard year, he had gone from leading two lives to managing almost half a dozen. Apprentice to Plagueis, Master to Maul, Distinguished Senator, ally of Supreme Chancellor Valorum, and leader of a growing cabal of conspirators that included Pestige, Doriana, Grigatus in line to replace him in the Senate, the force-sensitive human Sim Alu, intelligence analyst Armand Isard, Eriadu Senator Will of Tarkin, and Umbaran telepath Sly Moore, whom he had made his covert aide. And leading a double life of his own, Dooku, carrying out Jedi business while in private moments flirting with the dark side, hungry to bring the full power of the Force to bear in the mundane realm, his slow reorientation, a curious inversion of Darth Gravid's, whose similar reach for preeminence had exceeded his grasp. For the Jedi, mastery was conferred when one attained a true understanding of the ways of the Force. For the Sith, that level of understanding was merely the beginning. The Jedi Order's homespun cloaks announced, "I want for nothing because I am clothed in the Force." The cloaks of the Sith, "I am the light in the dark, the convergence of opposing energies." And yet, while all Sith lords were powerful, not all were brilliant or in complete possession of the powers the dark side granted them. Darth Millennial had rebelled against the teachings of his master, Darth Cognos, and even Plagueis spoke of having reached a philosophical impasse with his master, Tenebris. A human Sith lord whose short reign had elapsed some 5 centuries earlier, Gravid had been persuaded to believe that total commitment to the dark side would sentence the Sith Order to eventual defeat, and so had sought to introduce Jedi selflessness and compassion into his teachings and practice, forgetting that there can be no return to the light for an adept who has entered the dark wood, that the dark side will not surrender one to whom, by mutual agreement, it has staked a claim. Driven increasingly mad by his attempts to straddle the two realms, Gravid became convinced that the only way to safeguard the future of the Sith was to hide or destroy the lore that had been amassed through the generations, the texts, holocrons, and treatises, so that the Sith could fashion a new beginning for themselves that would guarantee success. Barricaded within the walls of a bastion he and his Twi'lek apprentice Gian had constructed on Jagawada, he had attempted as much, and was thought to have destroyed more than half the repository of artifacts before Gian, demonstrating consummate will and courage, had managed to penetrate the force fields Gravid had raised around their stronghold and intercede, killing her master with her bare hands, though at the cost of her arm, shoulder, and the entire left side of her face and chest. A Jedi master of high standing, Dooku possibly already had some theoretical understanding of the dark side. Perhaps more if he had access to Sith holocrons vaulted within the temple. He could certainly be a nuisance to the Republic, though hardly an agent of chaos, as Plagueis Insidious had been. Still, it would be interesting to see just how far Dooku might be willing to go. Palpatine would have to inform Plagueis of their conversation. Or would he? Was an apprentice ever permitted to conceal knowledge from his or her master? No, never. Especially not when there was a chance that Plagueis might learn of Dooku's apostasy on his own, in ways that remained unfathomable. Executing a reckless series of maneuvers, the Grand Driver had changed lanes and was descending rapidly for Tanic Spaceport. A semicircular docking pad, located at the edge of the Manai District and surrounded on all sides by towering monads. Reserved for low-impact freighters, the port was a haven for drugged and abducted crew members, itinerant workers, and undocumented migrants of diverse species, most of whom were in search of steerage passage to distant worlds. Glad to be released from the skycab, Palpatine edged his way into the crowds and set a course for the headquarters of the Refugee Relief Movement, whose stark offices were tucked under the port's recessed upper level. Halfway to his destination, he spied the stout Naboo he had come to see, standing alongside his slender wife and issuing commands to a group of young volunteers. Adopting an expression of good cheer and waving a hand in the air, Palpatine shouted,
Rui!
The man swung to the sound of his voice and smiled broadly.
Palpatine!
President of the RRM, Rui Naberi had a large, square head, thin lips, a clean-shaven face, and short hair clipped in high bangs. A one-time mountain man, a builder by trade, and a frequent guest lecturer on microeconomics at Leeds University, he was not easily fooled, and his default expression was one of sincerity. The non-profit organization he directed was devoted to providing aid for Coruscant's billions of lower-tier dwellers.
"What a happy coincidence," Rui said, pumping Palpatine's hand.
The two Naboo were close in age, but Rui was a product of public education rather than the series of private institutions young Palpatine had attended.
"You remember Jobal?"
A tall woman with a triangular-shaped face and wide-spaced and compassionate eyes, she was allowing herself to age gracefully, though her long hair was still dark and luxuriant. Married to Rui by arrangement, she was every bit as serious as he was, and equally committed to the refugee movement.
"Of course," Palpatine said.
Bowing his head, he added,
"Madame Naberi."
She made a move to hug him, then thought better of it and simply smiled in acknowledgement.
"How good to see you again, Senator."
Rui touched him on the back.
"I never had a chance to thank you in person for allowing me to address the Senate about the refugee crisis on Sev Tok."
Palpatine shrugged it off.
"It was my honor to be affiliated with such a worthy cause. Speaking of which, Anaconda Farr sends his regards." "Rodia should be proud of him," Rui said. "One of the few in the Senate who recognizes that good fortune should not be taken for granted, but should serve as an impetus for bringing comfort to those less fortunate."
Palpatine smiled tightly.
"What brings you to the dock, Senator?" Jobal asked. "More than coincidence, m'lady. In fact, a matter of utmost urgency that involves your daughter, Padme." "She's here," Rui said.
Palpatine looked at him.
"On Coruscant?" "Here, at Tanik."
He pointed to a nearby dock, where an energetic, dark-haired girl was directing an anti-grav pallet of foodstuffs into the bay of a waiting freighter. Catching sight of her father, Padme waved.
"Who is the young man with her?" Palpatine asked.
"Ian Lago," Jobal said. Palpatine sharpened his vision.
"The son of King Varuna's counselor?"
Jobal nodded.
"He's become a bit lovesick." "And Padme with him?" "We hope not," Rui said. "Ian's a nice boy, but..." "Well, let's just say that Kun Lago would not be happy to learn that his son has been fraternizing with the enemy, so to speak."
Realizing that young Ian was eyeing him with sudden interest, Palpatine returned the look for a moment, and then said,
"This brings me directly to the point of my visit. As you're no doubt aware, our king has instructed me to support the Trade Federation on the issue of taxation of the free trade zones." "Of course he would," Rui said with clear disdain. "How otherwise would Varuna continue to line the pockets of his robes with kickbacks?"
Palpatine nodded.
"You and I and some of the nobles know as much. But now may be the time to let the rest of Naboo in on his secrets."
Jobal's expression soured.
"If you're talking about challenging him in the coming election, you're facing a lost cause."
"I beg to disagree, madam," Palpatine said. "With discretion, I have already approached several members of the electorate, and they concur that Varuna can be defeated by the right candidate."
When he cut his gaze to Padme, Rui's mouth fell open.
"You can't be serious."
"But I am, Rui.
A member of the Legislative Youth Program at 8 years of age? A full apprentice legislator at 11? Her refugee work on Shada Biboran? Plus, she enjoys more popular support in Theed than any governor has enjoyed in generations."
Jobal blinked and shook her head in disbelief.
"Palpatine, She has only just turned 13.
Palpatine spread his hands.
Naboo has elected younger queens, m'lady, and hers could be a reign that will last 50 years.
He refused to yield to Rui or Jobal.
The Constitution has a provision that would allow the monarchy to become hereditary for a worthy dynasty. And what more worthy family is there than the Naberis?
Husband and wife traded looks.
That's very flattering, Senator,
Jobal started to say when Palpatine cut her off.
The Naboo are exasperated with monarchs like Tapalo and Varuna. Padme would allow Naboo to reinvent itself.
Rui mulled it over momentarily.
Even if Padme were to entertain the idea, I'm not sure she could be persuaded to support taxation of the trade zones, knowing what that might mean for Naboo and other outlying worlds.
She wouldn't have to take a stand, Palpatine countered. She need only campaign against corruption and secret deals, and the embarrassing position in which Varuna has placed Naboo.
Jobal's eyes narrowed in uncertainty.
At the risk of touching on a sore point, Senator, you helped put Varuna on the throne and have been his advocate ever since.
Palpatine shook his head.
Never an advocate. I have always considered myself to be a counterbalance. And in the past few years, we found ourselves on opposite sides of almost every issue, including the library he built and the credits he lavished on creating a space force for Naboo.
He fell silent for a moment,
then said, Trust me, Varuna can be defeated.
Again, Rui and Jobal exchanged worried looks.
We're provincial people, Palpatine, Rui said at last. The world of politics, galactic politics, no less.
Palpatine compressed his lips.
I understand, but what compelled the two of you to abandon the mountains for Theed, if not for Padme and Sola, and the opportunities that might be available to them?
Palpatine held Rui's pensive gaze. He is beginning to waver.
I wouldn't want to put Padme through this only to see her lose, Palpatine.
Palpatine beamed.
I will work with you to see that that doesn't happen. I don't wish to speak out of turn, but I can almost guarantee the support of the Supreme Chancellor as well.
Valorum knows of Padme?
Jobal asked in delighted surprise.
Of course he does, Palpatine paused. Faced with Padme as competition, perhaps Varuna will see the light and abdicate.
Jobal laughed, then showed Palpatine a serious look.
You have come a long way, Senator.
Chapter 26, Their Baser Nature. On a clear day, looking northwest across the works, from a debris-strewn room in the circular crown of the Limerge building, Maul could just see the elegant centermost spire of the Jedi Temple poking above the horizon. With his master en route to Eriadu to attend a trade summit Sidious himself had proposed, the Zebrak had made a habit of climbing to the crown at least once a day and, with electro-binoculars in hand, gazing at the distant spire in the hope of catching sight of a Jedi. But that hadn't happened. If any Jedi were present, they would be sitting in contemplation, as Maul knew he should be doing as well. Or if not meditating, then completing work on the graciously curved speeder bike he had named Bloodfin, or the droid called CP3X, or perfecting his skill at using the wrist-mounted projectile launcher known as the Lanbarak. Devoting himself to those tasks would have met with more approval from Darth Sidious than Maul staring at the temple's fin-ornamented pinnacle and dreaming of the day he could pit himself against a Jedi Master. But ever since his return from Dorvala, several standard weeks earlier, he had been too restless to sit cross-legged on the floor, immersed in the flow of the dark side, or to pore over the probe droid schematics Darth Sidious had furnished before he'd left. When Maul reflected on the time he had spent on Dorvala, his thoughts weren't focused on the assassinations he had carried out. He had murdered many in his short life, and there was nothing about the deaths of Patch Brewitt, Gamazan, and the others involved in the business of mining lomite ore that distinguished them from previous killings. In fact, the miners' carelessness should have condemned them to lingering deaths rather than the quick ends Maul had dispensed. What he remembered instead was the feeling of participation the mission had afforded. Not only had he been able to draw on his talents for stealth, tracking, and combat, but he had used them in a manner that furthered the Sith grand plan, as hadn't been the case during his years of training on Orsus or during the forays Darth Sidious had allowed him to make to other worlds. On his return to Coruscant, the Dark Lord had praised him, which Maul supposed should have been reward enough, and might have been had the mission led to another. But Darth Sidious had excluded him from participating in the Eriadu operation, and had been vague about future plans. A direct outcome of what Maul had accomplished on Dorvala, Lomite Limited and Intergalactic Ore had merged and been taken over by the Trade Federation, which in turn had resulted in Newt Gunray's promotion to the company's 7-member directorate. In further conversations with the Viceroy, Darth Sidious had demanded that the Nymordians willingly sacrifice one of their Lucre Hulk freighters, along with a shipment of Erodium ingots as a means of funding an Outer Rim insurgent group known as the Nebula Front. Maul had been nonplussed by his master's decision to reveal himself to the group's leader, as Darth Sidious had done in his initial communication with Gunray. Then dismayed to learn that the leader, a human named Havak, had betrayed Darth Sidious by attempting to assassinate Supreme Chancellor Valorum on Coruscant. The realization that his master could be deceived, that he wasn't infallible, had had a curious effect on Maul. It had caused him unease, a sudden concern for his master's safety that had intruded on his ability to still his mind and find reassurance in the dark side. It was not fear, for fear was something alien to Maul's makeup, but a troublesome disquiet. Disquiet for the being he had once tried to kill, and was perhaps expected to kill. All these weeks later, he would still sometimes spend hours wandering through the Limerge building, like a house pet picking up on the scent of its owner. When, though, he had expressed a desire to take part in the Eriadu operation, even if that only meant assisting the Nymordians in procuring weapons from the Hive species, or commencing manufacturing operations on Alaris Prime and other remote worlds, his master had rejected the idea out of hand.
"You have no role in this," he had said without explanation, and in compensation, Maul surmised, had given him the Dark Eye schematics.
The rejection, too, had prompted questions of a novel sort. Of all the beings in the galaxy, the Dark Lord had chosen him to serve as his apprentice and eventual successor. And yet Darth Sidious had neglected to equip him with the very tools he would need to carry the Sith imperative forward. For all his attempts to familiarize himself with the political landscape and with criminal organizations, some of which were allied to Darth Sidious, others antithetical to his plans, he had a limited understanding of precisely how the galaxy worked. He grasped that the Sith's war was with the Jedi Order rather than the Republic, but he had no real inkling as to how revenge was to be meted out. What then, if, beyond contemplation, something untoward should befall his master? Was there a contingency plan? Unlike Darth Sidious, who masqueraded as Republic Senator Palpatine and debated complex issues in the Senate, Maul lacked a secret identity. With his yellow eyes and horned head a black and red mask of arcane sigils, it was all he could do to prowl the fringes of the works in the dead of night without instilling fear in nearly every being whose gaze he caught. Maul had expected his life to change when Darth Sidious had relocated him to Coruscant, but in many ways,
The move struck him as a return to his days as a combat trainee on Orsus, waiting to be allowed to fight, receiving praise and rewards, only to be commanded to train harder. The occasional visits from his master had allowed him to endure the isolation and superficiality of his existence. Only when his instruction in the Sith arts had begun had he felt singular, purposeful. But he wasn't entirely without hope. On occasion, Darth Sidious would hint at a mission of utmost importance that they would need to carry out together, one that would call on them to make use of all their powers. He had yet to provide details, even with regard to Maul's studies, but he continued to imply that the mission was looming, and more, Maul sensed that it was somehow linked to his master's homeworld, Naboo. His presence requested by King Varuna, Palpatine interrupted his journey to the Eriadu summit to stop at Naboo. The spaceport was crowded with ships of unusual design, and Cleed was teeming with citizens who had packed the streets and lanes surrounding Palace Plaza to hear young Padme Naberi speak. In stark contrast with the joyous enthusiasm demonstrated by the crowds, and seemingly organized as a kind of counter-event, the palace throne room was the scene of an extravagant fete, attended by the most corrupt of Varuna's supporters in the electorate, and several dozen off-worlders of dubious character. The announcement of Palpatine's arrival at the room met with hushed innuendos and malicious laughter that continued while he was ushered to a place at the king's table, opposite Varuna, and sandwiched between Kun Lago and Security Chief Magneta. Motioning with his royal baton for decorum, Varuna greeted Palpatine with an exaggerated smile. "Welcome, Palpatine." Drinking had imparted a slight slur to his speech. Clapping his hands, he added, "Bring wine for Naboo's celebrated senator." "Thank your majesty," Palpatine said, playing along with Varuna's insincerity. "I've gone without blossom wine for too long." Varuna pounded a fist on the long wooden table. "Then bring him 2 goblets, and keep the supply flowing until his thirst is slaked." Palpatine sat back as servants hurried in to honor Varuna's command. Both ends of the table were anchored by beings he knew by reputation rather than acquaintance. Far to Varuna's right sat Alexei Garin, head of the Black Sun Crime Syndicate, and to his left, elevated on durable cushions and drawing smoke from a water pipe, lounged a female hut named Gardula from Tatooine. Among her retinue of beings were 2 humanoids whose martial uniforms identified them as members of the Bando Gora terrorist group. More ammunition for Padme Naberi, he thought.
"Tell us, Palpatine," Varuna said, after wiping his mouth on the sleeve of his gaudy robe. "What prompted you to propose this summit on Eriadu?"
Palpatine ignored the goblets of wine.
"The summit will provide an opportunity for everyone involved to air their thoughts and grievances regarding taxation of the trade zones."
"I'm certain that your friends in the Trade Federation are very appreciative."
Palpatine waited for the laughter to end, pleased to find that the conversation was headed in the direction he had expected it to go.
"Naboo has a great stake in what emerges from the summit, Majesty."
"Ah, then you arrange this for the sake of Naboo?"
Varuna raised his voice so that everyone at the table could hear.
"Palpatine did this out of concern for Naboo."
His expression toughened as he leaned forward.
"And no doubt you were thinking of Naboo when you approached the Naberis about having their daughter oppose me in the coming election."
"Think twice before you offer any denials," Magneta told him quietly.
Lago leaned over to add,
"My son was present when you tendered the offer."
"With Padme Naberi, if I'm not mistaken," Palpatine said, in like conspiracy.
While Lago was trying to puzzle it out, he looked at Varuna.
"We discussed the refugee movement."
The monarch glared at him, then motioned dismissively with his fingertips.
What's done is done, and I'm afraid that includes you, Senator.
Gesturing broadly.